This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
I dealt with diplomacy and conciliation, like the Arms Control and Disarmament Agency, and then George W. Bush came along and made the worst national security decision any American president ever made, going into Iraq in a war that was based on nothing but lies and false intelligence and tailored intelligence and items that were cut out of whole cloth. And then Barack Obama came along and said that Afghanistan is a war of necessity, which of course it wasn't, and I think it took him 3 years to realize that. And now we have to wonder, will we ever get the government back in the hands of a civilian power structure to get away from what Eisenhower warned about, which was the military-industrial complex. And In the book, I say it's a military-industrial congressional intelligence complex, and civilian leadership is going to have to assert itself to ever get this country back on the right track.
Well, why don't we start a little more with Eisenhower? It's interesting. He's famous for this warning about the military-industrial complex. And it's interesting to me is that he did this at his sort of his farewell speech.
Exactly. But there were four warnings that Eisenhower gave over his two terms in office. One was the last speech, the farewell speech, the military-industrial complex warning, which is what we're living with now. But early on in his first term, he gave a speech that I wish he had followed up with in terms of a major theme, and that was the Cross of Iron speech. And he basically said, when we're dealing with military spending, we're actually spending the sweat of our laborers, the genius of our scientists and our engineers, and the hopes of our children, because all of the things we put unnecessarily into military spending will mean that we can't build bridges, we can't build schools, we can't repair infrastructure. And we're certainly in that economic situation now where this country cannot afford to do the things that it needs to do. Then the third warning was that any time you're in an environment of permanent war, and we've been in an environment of permanent war since the 9/11 attacks, then you're going to have restrictions on civil liberties and personal rights. And we've certainly seen that in this country with warrantless eavesdropping, with the use of torture and abuse by the CIA, with the absence of due process to conduct these drone flights in Pakistan and Yemen and Somalia and pretty soon in Western Africa. And then finally, a warning that he didn't put in writing, but he said it to his close advisors on his way out of the White House: God help the United States when the people who sit in this chair after me do not know how to deal with the military, do not know how to talk to the military, and essentially do not understand the military. And if you look at American presidents, particularly the current one, Obama, who seems intimidated by the military, that's the situation we've been in. Civilian presidents who've come in, often inexperienced, often without a good background in national security affairs or foreign policy, that have put too much stock and too much confidence in the policies of the Pentagon, and particularly in the procurement policies of the Pentagon, which has run defense spending up to nearly $1 trillion a year, which is more than the rest of the world spends on defense.
Yeah, it's interesting that all these presidents you discuss in your book, I mean, well, someone like Bush the First did serve in the military, but he was not a very high-ranking officer. I believe he was a pilot, but Eisenhower was right up there at the top, so he sort of knew the military through and through.
He knew the military, and he didn't really sympathize with the demands of the military or the hardline civilians. For example, the Gaither Report, 1955, 1956, that called for increased spending on defense. He knew that wasn't necessary. He knew that the United States had a huge edge in military power over its rivals. So he kept the lid on defense spending. And what you've had in the last 10 years is a doubling of the defense budget, which includes a lot of Cold War platforms built in terms of excessive numbers, like the F-35, which is going to be this country's first trillion-dollar fighter aircraft system. In fact, the first trillion-dollar defense platform for any of the services. You have a nuclear component that's been built to incredible excess. You have a national missile defense in California and Alaska that doesn't work, but you now have the new Secretary of Defense who's just announced he wants to expand it and add 14 more interceptor sites. So there seems no end to the demands that the military makes on our economy, on our treasure, on our expertise and our resources, and we're being squeezed by that, mm-hmm. and that's why we can't do the domestic things that we need to do. Mm-hmm. You know, Obama came in by saying we have to do nation building, but we have to start at home. Well, he hasn't really followed up on that, I don't believe.
Mm-hmm. Well, I know that, you know, Eisenhower, he kind of avoided full-scale wars, but he seemed to like covert actions. You know, we have Iran in 1953, Guatemala the next year, we have the Bay of Pigs, the assassination of Patrice Lumumba in 1960, and in Iraq, you know, we have the attempted assassination of the ruler of Iraq in 1959, where the U.S. hired a young thug named Saddam Hussein to assassinate the president of Iraq.
Yeah, you've identified really the downside of the Eisenhower administration. Mm-hmm. Eisenhower's thinking, and I'm not defending him on this because I'm very critical of him in the book, was that in order to avoid using the military, in order to avoid excessive military spending, in order to keep a lid on the defense budget, that you could use the Central Intelligence Agency to conduct secret wars, to conduct regime change. That's not what Harry Truman wanted when he created the CIA in 1947.
Mm-hmm.
But in 1953, as you point out, that was the first exercise in regime change. And when you think about it, it took place in Iran. One, it was against the democratically elected leader of Iran, Mossadegh. And two, this is a problem that still exists in the minds of Iranians, because I think what Iran believes is that we tried to overthrow their government once in the 1950s and had a role to play in the installation of the corrupt regime of the Shah of Iran, who mm-hmm. finally left in 1979. What's to stop the United States from engaging in regime change once again to overthrow the Khomeini government, to overthrow the Ayatollahs? And I think this was what drives the Iran in terms mm-hmm. of their insecurity and their interest in some kind of bilateral negotiations with the United States to have an understanding about stability in international affairs. But no, Eisenhower definitely put us on this track. You mentioned some of the major cases, and what he did made it easier for someone like John F. Kennedy, a very new, young, inexperienced president, to engage in the ridiculous perfect failure, which was the Bay of Pigs.
Wow, I think we're going to have to take a little time out now to talk about our membership, and then we will be back and we'll talk about some more of these presidents. So let's go out and talk with Carlos and Will.
Thank you, Per. It's great to be here with everybody who's listening to this fascinating discussion with Mel Goodman and obviously our terrific presenter, Per. And we're trying to raise some money for this great radio station. So if you could call us at 877-500-5266. That's 877-500-5266. Even if you can't donate, say, $120 to be a sustaining member, just a one-time donation would really help out. If you could just call up right now and donate $25, $30, whatever you find is affordable. But we do have some great offers on things. If you want to donate $120, that's just $10 a month. You could get the T-shirt from Democracy Now!, a very popular show we play twice a day. And you can also donate online at KBOO.FM. That's our website, and there's an icon, I believe, on our webpage that you can click on to donate money there. Isn't that right, Carlos?
That is right, most definitely. And, you know, this is another, you know, wonderful example of the type of programming that we do here at KBOO. You know, Per has been one of KBOO's gems of the public affairs programming here.
And crown jewel, if you will.
That's right, yeah. And we appreciate having him here and bringing on guests like Mr. Mel Goodman to speak about basically the military complex from a perspective that you're not going to hear in other places. We're getting some really in-depth information that tends to be kind of glossed over in most media outlets today. Unfortunately, you know, it's this type of information isn't more readily available to folks, but
it really isn't. That's
no,
true.
No. When you tune into KBOO, though, you get this. You know, and this is the type of programming that we put together on a regular basis.
And this is knowledge. This is genuine knowledge, what we're offering
it's
here.
Empowerment,
it's not just
really.
Fluff. And it's definitely empowerment. It's one of the reasons I volunteer with KBOO, and it's one of the reasons I listen to KBOO. And I know you folks out there feel the same way. And maybe you don't have some time to come on down to KBOO, where we're always open to the public, well, during office hours, I shouldn't say always. But if you call us at 877-500-5266, you can donate some money to keep these terrific shows on the air and keep these wonderful guests like Mel Goodman calling up and providing this information, this knowledge, and this empowerment. And we really appreciate every call that comes in, and we have some wonderful volunteers here who are ready to answer the phone and receive your terrific donation. So thank you, everybody who's called up so far. And if you folks are out there planning on calling up, then let's get that done real soon so you can have a great morning and feel very good about yourself for doing something positive.
Okay, we are back with our guest, Mel Goodman, author of National Insecurity, The Cost of American Militarism. In the book, you go through, Bush 1 and Bush 2 and Bill Clinton, but why don't we sort of skip ahead to Barack Obama? And in the chapter on Obama, you know, you say that he kind of defers to the Pentagon. At least he did at first. He seems to be having second thoughts. Let's talk a little bit more about President Obama.
Well, I think the initial problem with Obama, and I'm an Obama supporter, I was then, I still am, but I think we knew in 2008 during the campaign that this was a man who was new to Washington, very inexperienced in national security affairs, not very knowledgeable in foreign policy. And I think this was given away when he appointed his national security team, which was an incredibly weak team of foreign policy people. He placed Hillary Clinton in at the State Department with no background in foreign policy. He did that for domestic reasons in order to keep the Clinton Corporation, Bill and Hillary, on board. He kept Robert Gates in as Secretary of Defense, which he should not have done. Bob Gates politicized intelligence at the CIA in the 1980s. He was a Cold War advisor to George Bush, both father and son. He should have been moved on, but again, for domestic reasons, Obama kept him in place in order to appease the military and to appease the right wing of the country. He put a retired Marine general, James Jones, in at the White House as the national security advisor. This was a disaster, and Jones was out within 18 months. And he placed Leon Panetta, a very tired bureaucrat from California, in at the CIA, and within months, Panetta was captured by the operational mentality and bureaucracy of the Central Intelligence Agency. Now I think I am somewhat hopeful, as you say you are, because when you look at the new appointments, particularly John Kerry at State and Chuck Hagel at Defense, he's got a man in terms of John Kerry who has spent his professional and most of his political life in preparing for the job to be steward of American foreign policy. Chairman of the Foreign Affairs Committee in the Senate for a long period of time, the son of a foreign service officer, growing up in part in Europe, speaking several European languages, taking special trips as a special emissary for both Democratic and Republican presidents. I think the Kerry appointment was a good one. Hagel, I think, also was a good appointment, and he's already announced two things that I think are very important. He wants to reexamine the pivot toward Asia because he doesn't think we can afford it with the current defense budget, and frankly, I don't think we need it. There's no need to gratuitously confront China with a pivot toward Asia when we certainly have ample military power in Asia already. And he's announced that we're not going to put the final stage of interceptors in East Europe as a protection against missiles from Iran. The idea of a regional missile defense in Eastern Europe because of a possible Iranian attack against Eastern Europe or Europe in general makes no sense whatsoever. So with these two appointments, maybe the hope is father to the thought here, but I think he has learned from experiences with the military, and he knows now that the military is dragging its heels on getting out of Afghanistan, and he's going to have to really show some real resolve and steel himself to deal with that kind of pressure. But I am somewhat optimistic that this very bright man, this very thoughtful man, has learned some lessons from the first term when mistakes were made.
Do you think he'll keep us out of a big conflict with Iran?
I think it's clear that he does not want a conflict with Iran. What I would like to see and don't see is more energetic diplomacy from the White House and from the State Department. There's too much out there in the way of low-hanging fruit and also in the way of challenges that should be met with diplomacy. Cuba's a perfect example. We should recognize the Cuban government and move on. And I think the death of Hugo Chavez in Venezuela, which was a real setback for Cuba because of all of the economic support that Chavez provided to Cuba, was an opportunity just to recognize Cuba and forget the last 50, 60 years of non-recognition, which never made any sense. I think Iran is a clear case where we should use not just military pressure and economic pressure, which frankly haven't worked. We've been applying sanctions against Iran since 1979. And why in the world do you send additional aircraft carriers in the Persian Gulf just to up the ante of coercive policy when it's clear that Iran is not going to respond to pressure of that type? What Iran wants is a guarantee that, that we're not going to engage in regime change once again, as we did in 1953. And you could say the same thing for North Korea, where I think we've created and contributed to a phony, threatening situation. North Korea is a problem. There's no doubt about that. They have a young leader who does not appear stable, but a lot of his provocative remarks appears aimed at a domestic audience because the country is starving, the country is economically backward, and of course this new young leader, the son and grandson of former leaders of North Korea, is trying to show he's in charge and that he sits on top of a strong military and that he really has military power to challenge North Korea's enemies. The fact of the matter is the economic situation is totally backward. He knows he could be blamed for that, so he's creating a false crisis. But why do we have to be flying B-52s, additional B-52s over the Korean Peninsula? And yesterday we even overflew North Korean airspace. This is an unnecessary provocation of a country we know very little about. And it's interesting when you mention Cuba, Iran, and North Korea, and not knowing a lot about any of those countries, really, and having very poor intelligence collection on those three countries, those are three countries we don't recognize. So if you don't recognize the countries, you don't have a State Department presence, you don't have an embassy in the capitals of those countries, and if you don't have an embassy, you don't have a State Department station, a Central Intelligence Agency station, which could be there to collect and analyze intelligence. So we spend a lot of time shooting ourselves in the foot on these very important issues, and we have to get away from the fact that military power is the only answer. You know, to paraphrase Mark Twain, if the only tool in your toolbox is a hammer, then all these problems are going to start to look like nails.
Yeah,
and
lots
that's
of
the kind of situation we've had. Uh-huh.
Well, I think we're going to go out to Carlos and Will again, and then we'll come back to our guest, and we'll talk some more about his book, National Insecurity.
Yeah, thanks, Bear. This is Carlos and
Will right here. Pleasure to be here.
Yeah, and we're jumping on the microphones here to encourage our listeners, you, the listener, to invest in the type of community-powered, community-driven programming that we're putting together to for you on a regular basis. This is the type of programming that you can become. Involved in. You know, you can actually become a volunteer and get hands-on training and learn a lot of what's going on here to actually become a producer yourself, an engineer, what have you. That's the type of programming that's done here at KABU.
That's for sure. And every day people come in and they take classes. They learn how to work the equipment, how to put together a news story. There are many, many opportunities down here. It really is part of the community, and it is a community. Mm-hmm. And if you call up at 877-500-5266, that's 877-500-5266, you can become part of that community, and you can help this radio station stay on the air, keep our bills paid, and keep everybody broadcasting this wonderful and very valuable information.
Well, before Will wears out your ears and gives you cauliflower ear, I want to, there's two things that I want to get out there. I'm just giving Will a little bit. But anyways, there's two things that I want you to be aware of. First of all, if you donate a minimum pledge of $60, you can get the book that the author Mel Goodman that's on the air today with
called?
It's called National Insecurity: The Cost of American Militarism.
Sounds good.
And it basically details all the information that you're hearing today on Per's show, but in more depth. The other thing that I want to mention before we jump off real quick is I want to thank some of the renewing members: Biana from PDA or from Portland, Helen from Gresham, Richard from Silverton.
Thank you, folks.
Yeah, Jim from Portland, Steve from Gresham, and Soraya from Vancouver. I want to thank you all for your pledges. And just to remind everyone, it is the phone number is 877-500-5266.
Okay, we're back with Mel Goodman, author of National Insecurity. It might be National Insolvency, but there's one thing I'd like to touch upon in our last few minutes here, because it's not really talked about very much, and you have a chapter on our phantom missile defense. So why don't we talk about that a little bit?
Well, this is a system we've been pursuing for 60 years. It came up in the Eisenhower administration in the 1950s. And over the 60 years of testing and throwing money at this problem, we still throw $10 billion a year at the problem. We have never solved the major obstacle to developing missile system, and that is no system can tell the difference between an actual missile and a decoy. So most presidents have avoided actually deploying the system, but George W. Bush changed all that, and now Barack Obama is going along with it by expanding the system, because it was Bush who put a national missile defense into California and Alaska, where there are 30 interceptor sites, and now Obama wants to add 14 more. Even Ronald Reagan talked about Star Wars, but he never really deployed anything. He never wasted money on actual procurement of a national missile defense. Obama's gone further with deploying these 14 additional, plus creating this regional defense in Eastern Europe by putting interceptors and radars in Poland and Romania. This kind of defense is unnecessary because it could spark another arms race in the strategic area. And what we need to do, and which most presidents have recognized, is without an anti-ballistic missile system, then you can make real cuts in strategic offensive systems. Mm-hmm. This is what drove Nixon and Kissinger in the 1970s. This was what Bill Clinton agreed to when he was president in the 1990s. But George W. Bush, who was really a creature of the military-industrial complex and a creature of Dick Cheney and Donald Rumsfeld, who took the country to war illegally and immorally in 2003, also threw too much money into defense, abolished the ABM Treaty, the Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty, and started the deployment of a national missile defense that doesn't even work.
Isn't there a sense in which, this sort of strange logic of mutually assured destruction in which a defense is really kind of offensive? Because it means you can you don't have to worry about a retaliation.
Exactly. That's why the two sides agreed during the Cold War not to build an anti-ballistic missile defense. Because if you think you have a defensive system that works, then you can try a first attack and deny a retaliatory launch to the other side. So we live with this peril of a mutual assured destruction capability. But that's what putting this nuclear genie and getting it out of the bottle has done to us. What we have to recognize is that we need far fewer nuclear weapons. This idea of throwing $50 billion every year into our nuclear force, and for the last strategic arms agreement that Obama negotiated, he had to pay off the Republicans in the Senate, led by John Kyle of Arizona, to give $80 billion additional to the Department of Energy to modernize a force that needs no modernization. There was a secret panel that met 2009, the Jason panel, which reported to the Defense Department, that said we don't have to modernize. We have a very sufficient force. We don't need new strategic missiles. We've overbuilt considerably. Over the years, we've built 70,000 nuclear warheads.
Oh,
right
my.
Now, we have 2,500 warheads deployed. We have 2,500 in reserve. We have another 1,000 or so in different categories. There aren't thousands of targets for nuclear weapons. This is basically a weapon system that has no utility whatsoever. So
mm-hmm.
The important thing is to keep countries such as Iran from obtaining nuclear weapons, to keep North Korea from continuing to test nuclear weapons, to get India and Pakistan and Israel, who have nuclear weapons, to get them into the Non-Proliferation Treaty. You know, we wring our hands about Iran, which has no nuclear weapons, but we ignore the fact that Israel has 200 nuclear warheads.
Mm-hmm.
When I left the CIA, that's what the intelligence suggested, 150 to 200 nuclear warheads.
Wow. I think we'll have to leave.
Tactical type. They're not members of the Non-Proliferation Treaty,
uh-huh.
And no one ever discusses this nuclear arsenal.
Well, we're discussing it right now, and I really want to thank you for being with us. Mel Goodman, author of National Insecurity, The Cost of American Militarism. So thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Per. It was great to be with you.
And now we can go back to Will and Carlos, and they can tell you how you can get this book. I can say it's just packed full of information. It's a lot of stuff in there. It's a really an interesting book, and it's yours for a $60 minimum pledge.
Yeah, if you call us at 877-500-5266, that's 877-500-5266, you can get that book for a $60 pledge. That's obviously a donation, plus you get the book as a sort of thank you gift for donating. And that really was a fascinating show that Mel Goodman and Pear just put on for us. And there's obviously a lot more detail in the book. It's full of rich information. And KBOO isn't rich, unfortunately, and we need you to call up right now. If you call up and just pledge, say $10 a month, that's 120 bucks a year, but it divided up between each month, it's only 10 bucks. And you'll be helping your community and this radio station. So if you call up right now at 877-500-5266, that we have some lovely volunteers here who are eagerly waiting for you to call and pledge whatever you feel you can afford right now. And we have many other things to offer, as well as this excellent book by Mel Goodman. Why don't you tell us about that, Carlos?
Well, we've got a lot of different T-shirts. But in case you are interested in the book, the name of the book is National Insecurity, The Cost of American Militarism, by Pear's guest, Mel Goodman. But yes, we've got coffee mugs, we've got T-shirts, we've got a brand new KBOO T-shirt that everybody's seems to be talking about. With KBOO Community Radio on the front. It's not just for commie pinko freaks, self-righteous gutter punks, drug-addled peaceniks, anarcho-syndicalists, hippie tree huggers, gay hillbillies, militant vegans, geriatric deadheads, or the foil hat brigade anymore.
I think that T-shirt is just hilarious. Yeah, I think that's cool. A really funny T-shirt. I'm going to try and score myself one of those, but you can get one by just calling us up at 877-500-5266. Or you can also donate online. We have a website, of course. It's kboo.fm. And there is a donation icon, I believe, on the first page of our website, sometimes referred to as a tip jar, but I believe that's incorrect. So it's a donation icon. And you can pledge any amount of money you would like if you want to be a sustaining member. That is, of course, very, very helpful to this station.
And the legal you're listening to KBOO 90.7 FM. Actually, I should say KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. And you can stream online at kboo.fm.
Compare, shop, try, and buy at the Better Living Home, Garden, and Lifestyle Show, March 22nd through 24th at the Portland Expo Center. This show will introduce you to businesses and groups in our region that can help you make positive and responsible consumer choices. They'll cover renewable resources, electric transportation, and other ways to leave a smaller footprint on our earth. It's the Better Living Home, Garden, and Lifestyle Show, Friday, March 22nd through Sunday, March 24th. More information can be found at kboo.fm/betterliving2013.
Good morning, Cascadia. Good morning, Cascadia. Today is Thursday, March 21st, and it's the first day of spring membership drive here at your community radio station, KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM and on the radio, of course, if you're listening, and kboo.fm on the web. Kathleen Stevenson's the KBOO AM News and Public Affairs Director. The engineer this morning is Roch Bergeron. The headlines interviews and analysis that you hear on Air Cascadia could only happen with your support. And that's why it is. These are some of the most critical weeks out of the entire year for the station. We have a few headlines at first, but we've got a guest. We've got Shahid Buttar with the Bill of Rights Defense Committee speaking, who's going to join us on the show today. But, of course, as many people know, this was a stunner of a week for those who are attempting to protect our watersheds and wildlands. The Supreme Court ruled that runoff from logging roads was not harmful for streams. That's it in a nutshell. And, of course, conservation groups and environmental resistance are regrouping and planning for what the next step is in defending the forest. Longshoremen also are regrouping and thinking about the next stage in the fight to protect their rights and their fair treatment. And as the world knows, President Obama, of course, is visiting the Middle East. He was in Israel, and he made remarks which any thinking person would be cause for alarm. Meanwhile, up in Canada, tar sands opponents have won another round. First, the National Weather Service, though, before we get to all of that. Showers likely today, overcast skies with a high near 49 tonight. We have a slight chance of showers, lows around 38, and that wind is still hanging on. It's got its teeth sunk in. We could have gusts up to 18 miles per hour in places tonight. For tomorrow, not much in the way of wet. We have a high of around 49, and for Friday night, look for overcast skies, lows around 36. I will not go into any detail at all today on the alternative forecast. Suffice it to say that we have a waxing gibbous flower moon in Gemini, 9 days old, and that's about it. Now, before we touch upon news from around Cascadia, we do have news from around Cascadia indeed, but we are fortunate, and of course on the first day of membership drive, to have a guest who is familiar to many listeners to Air Cascadia,